Okay, we'll bring the Committee from Public Safety, Policy and Finance, Crime Prevention to include the judiciary to order, and we'll start a roll call.
Representative Cornish?
Here.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Considine?
Here.
Representative Dean?
I'm here.
Representative Pertoss?
Here.
Representative Hillstrom?
Here.
Representative Howe? Representative Lohmer?
Here.
Representative Lucero? Representative Neuberger?
Ready to serve.
Representative O'Neill? Representative Quam?
Present.
Representative Rosenthal?
Here.
Representative Schoen? Representative Ward?
Here.
Representative Winkler?
Here.
And Representative Zerwas?
Here.
Okay, we have a quorum, and we'll start off with somebody want to move the minutes from February 3rd. Representative Dean moves the minutes for February 3rd. Any problem with the minutes? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion carried. Members, we're going to have a couple of bills. Representative Hillstrom is going to present today, followed by the Sentencing Guidelines Commission budget presentation. The bills of Representative Hillstrom, House File 199 and 241, will be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. After the testimony is done, and Representative Hillstrom, are you ready? We'll take testimony from Representative Hillstrom presenting her bill, and her testifiers and afterwards will ask if there's anybody that wishes to comment on the bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 199 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Public Safety Omnibus Bill. And, Mr. Chair, then I'd just like to have my testifiers speak to the bill after I present just a few words, if that's okay.
Here, thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, House File 199 was brought to me by my local law enforcement. With me is a representative from the Brooklyn Center Police Department, and then I brought someone from the Anoka County Attorney's Office to answer any questions that you might have after the presentation. But members, first-degree burglary is the crime that people used to use in Minnesota and in some places still do when someone breaks into a residence when there's a no-contact order. So when someone is breaking into your home to say, I can still get you, it was always previously charged as a burglary. There was a Supreme Court case, State v. Calvin, that caused us to question Minnesota statute. And the bill has to be put held over for possible inclusion because the sentencing guidelines put a preliminary fiscal note on it, and I want you to know that I'll be working really hard on that because based on the fact that it used to always be done this way, it's kind of hard to believe that there's over an $800,000 fiscal note on it. But I'd like to have the Brooklyn Center Police Department really talk about what the incident was that caused them to approach me about this bill. So,
Mr. Peters, right?
With me is Mr. Peters from the Brooklyn Center Police Department. You have to talk into the mic.
Go ahead, sir, with your name and title first.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Peters. I'm a commander with the Brooklyn Center Police Department.
Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. So the case stems from an incident between a mother and her adult son. I'll refer to the mother as the victim and the adult son as the suspect. The suspect has a history of mental health and substance abuse problems, and there were constant issues at the home. So the mother decided to get an order for protection, which was advised by law enforcement, which she obtained back in November. 8 days later, she was downstairs with her juvenile daughter, and she heard a loud crash. And she went upstairs. She called police before going upstairs, and she found her son now in the hallway, looked at her, turned away, and ran. We were not able to locate him at that time. But again, in the past, he's threatened to kill her, and he's done that several times. Since that, so we charged the case with an OFP violation as well as first-degree burglary. It was declined by the county attorney. During a 30-day time period, this son broke into the house five additional times, and one of those incidents turned into a domestic assault where she was physically assaulted, and in that case, he was arrested. But this is a constant issue, especially with order for protections, of the suspect going back and following through sometimes with the threats that they make.
Thank you, sir. Representative Hilster?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like Paul Young. He's from the Anoka County Attorney's Office. He's the head of the criminal division. He actually has prosecuted these kinds of cases and now supervises folks who prosecute these cases. And I'd like him to talk a little bit about, from the county attorney's perspective, when they see these cases and the case law that causes the problem.
Welcome, sir. Go ahead and state your name and title and then begin.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Paul Young, and I'm the Division Chief for Violent Crime in the Anoka County Attorney's Office. And what we see in these kinds of cases is the act by the defendant, the suspect, is really preying upon the vulnerabilities of the victim, because now we have a victim who has done what they are supposed to do. They've gotten the OFP, they've gotten a no-contact order, and now this person comes back and is in the home. That's where these cases stem from. That's the issue that was in the Colvin case. That's the issue that the officer is describing to you. And the way that the Colvin case came down and the way that that statute is currently written, the burglary statute is written, it appears as if the prosecuting authority might have some challenges based on the current language, because the Colvin case suggests if your only crime to get the predicate offense for the burglary is the mere trespass, just being there, the Colvin case suggests that's not good enough for a first-degree burglary. What this amendment does, it says, hey, if you're there, your mere presence in violation of the order for protection, the no-contact order, that is now going to be a clear-cut burglary. Victims shouldn't have to worry about whether the document, the order for protection, was filled out correctly, because the Colvin case talks about which box was checked. Many OFPs are obtained without the benefit of counsel. So there are a lot of things that go into the fact that a victim's safety could be compromised, not by any fault of the victim. What this case would allow us to do, and I understand the fiscal note, but what this case and this amendment allow us to do is to at least have the option to look at these offenders who come back and are trying to straight out intimidate their victim by being present again at the home where maybe they lived before, but now there's supposed to be a document, a court order that precludes them from being there. They're showing up anyway. This amendment would allow us to at least have the flexibility to charge those cases at a higher than misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor level. Doesn't mean they all have to go to prison, but it gives us a lot more sentencing options and a longer probationary period if they don't go to prison to try to manage the conduct and provide a longer period of safety for the victim. What happens, just as you were suggesting, the only crime that can be charged under Colvin would be that misdemeanor, if it's your first one, that misdemeanor violation of the order for protection. And that is not at all what we think can provide the most safety for a victim. These are people going back in, breaking into the house where maybe they used to live or where the victim now lives, just being there. We know that if they assault the victim or steal something, those are burglaries, and those are easier cases. The case law is very clear. But sometimes just being there, just scaring the victim, just sending that message to the victim that I'm going to get in, is horrifying for a lot of victims. So that's why we support and think that this amendment will do good things for victims.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hilstrom, more or questions now, or what do you like?
Mr. Chair, I just have one more. Ms. Hugdahl, and I'll let her have my chair here.
Members, after Ms. Hugdahl's testimony, we'll allow for questions. Go ahead, ma'am, state your name and title. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Aid. I wanted to speak in support of Representative Hilstrom's bill. What we know about domestic violence is that really these relationships are about power and control and manipulation. We also know that victims, if they don't feel the system's adequately protecting them, they start taking chances. And those often lead to very bad outcomes. So the bill is about burglary, entering a home when you know the victim is there, entering that home and being there when you know you're not supposed to be there. So to achieve fear, if you think about it in the context of domestic violence cases, the control of breaking into a home when you aren't supposed to be there can be a very, very effective way of communicating the message to the victim that you still have control and power, that you can come into what they probably consider their safest place with what has been available to them as their safest protection, which is an order to protect their safety. And despite those steps, if someone can get into that home and show that they can still control their environment, that is terrifying for these victims. And so to have this tool available for prosecution in the right cases can really help prevent those, so we don't see those violation orders stacking up and stacking up, as the officer talked about, so that we don't see victims starting to take chances feeling that that order is not protecting them enough, and then we see even worse outcomes happening. So thank you for your time, and we are very supportive of Representative Hillstrom's bill. Thank you.
And with that, Mr. Chair, we're prepared to answer any questions.
Okay, members will take questions on this testimony you just heard or the previous people, and we'll start off with Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hillstrom for bringing this bill forward. The question I have is that maybe you could just clarify some of the language for me here. On line 1.9, well, just on the bill here, it says, I'll start on 1.7, burglary in the first degree, whoever enters a building without consent and with the intent to commit a crime, enters a building without consent and commits a crime while in the building. In the new language here, or enters a building without consent in violation of an order for protection. I just there's been a lot of talk here about, you know, having the home being the safe place, and I wholeheartedly agree with you. But I just want to clarify this: if you have two parties, one has the order against them, would this also include public buildings? Because I keep hearing you folks talk about entering the home, and I get that and I agree with that, but when I see the language, it says or enters a building. So if he walks into Walmart and there she is, could this potentially be a problem? The language to me just seems vague, and I just would like to have some intent and some clarification on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'll first take a stab at it, and then we can have Mr. Young back me up if there's anything I need clarification on. But when you enter a building, if you just say the residence, then if you enter the garage, a garage, unless it's attached, is not part of the home. If you enter the shed that's attached to the property, I mean, sometimes these are the same kinds of buildings. If it's a public place, then you're not entering without consent because it's open to the public. So these would be, you know, you break into a closed business. You break into a garage that's not attached to the house. That's the reason you use the phrasing building.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hillstrom. Yeah, that clarifies things. So basically the whole issue of consent is entering. I get that now. I appreciate the clarification. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Spirius, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, I just wanted to point out in line 1.13, one of the elements is that the building is a dwelling, and then the other ones are with a weapon or assaulting.
Thank you. So this would mean, what you're saying then, that this can't be any building, this would have to be a dwelling?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, if it's under Clause 1. Otherwise, there has to be a weapon or an assault involved.
Okay. Representative Neuberger, you had a follow-up?
No, I'm good, thank
you. Okay, Representative Zerwas, to this point. Representative Quam, to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm curious about, with homelessness, if a dwelling or building is being utilized by the homeless to sleep or live in for a period of time, does that blur what is considered a dwelling and the effects of where charges could be brought? I know it's an obscure thing, but unfortunately we have quite a few instances in the area.
Representative Hillstrom, you're our, or was the question of Asperius? What you're asking is, this doesn't do anything with the rest of the law that's already existing, does it? I mean, as far as the definition of dwelling or whatever, only thing you're changing this law is to put enter a building without consent, a violation or a protection. All the other definitions of the dwelling and residence and everything is the same as it was previously. Does that answer your question, or do you want more clarification?
No, the question was, the staff, sorry, Mr. Chair, the staff mentioned it has to be a dwelling. Now, does that definition of dwelling include structures utilized by homeless? So it's a general clarification of what the staff was mentioning.
Ms. Pierce.
Mr. Chair and members, I haven't looked into that question directly. The definition of dwelling is a building used as a permanent or temporary residence. So I'm making an assumption that, you know, even if it is a temporary residence, if they enter the building and it's a considered a dwelling, that would apply. But I can't say that I've looked into that question directly.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Zer, did you want to have a follow-up?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say, lawyers say a lot, it depends. And the reason it depends is it really does depend if it meets the definition. And we'd look at case law in those kinds of situations to find out what the court has interpreted to include or not include. But we wouldn't rule it out solely because the person was homeless.
Okay, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to take a moment to thank Representative Hillstrom for bringing this forward. I think that the change that came down from the courts that prevented these charges for these incidences from being charged as a first-degree burglary, I think the big thing is if you've dealt with domestic violence victims, the biggest thing is, especially once you have an order for protection in place, is this idea that, you know, nothing happens, you know, quote-unquote, nothing happens, and the cops won't do anything until I get hurt, until the victim is kind of re-victimized. And so I think the reality is if you have someone that's breaking in to someone's home, knowingly violating an order for protection, I mean, there's intent to harm, there's intent to fear, to cause fear, but clearly the victim in that case shouldn't be in a position where, well, this time he didn't assault me, so it doesn't qualify as a first-degree burglary. I mean, that's crazy talk. So we need to go back to what we've been doing, and I want to thank Commander Peters for coming in, and then Assistant County Attorney Paul Young, who in a previous life I had the pleasure of working with when I was at the Anoka County Sheriff's Office. So I think this is a good bill, and I thank Representative Hillstrom for moving it forward.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hillstrom. This may be an exception or maybe an anomaly in the circumstance in which you're trying to apply modification of this law, but I've had the unfortunate circumstance of knowing individuals or persons who, through adjudication of divorce or other circumstances, will seek an order for protection. Oftentimes, it's alleged by many that the order is unfounded, but nonetheless, courts tend to err in favor of the petitioner. And how do you really address the circumstance in which the person entering the building, and I'm aware of some situations where someone who has an OFP says, you know, they've stayed apart, but the person makes a contact that he wants to come home and pick up some stuff or is going out of town or whatever. How do you deal with a fee owner of the property? Generally, we think of burglary as somebody who's not an owner of the property entering a domicile or a premise. How do you really rectify this little catch-all where somebody who's the fee owner of the property and maybe subjected to an OFP, or even in fragmented families where a girlfriend is living in the house and gets an OFP and the guy says, fine, you know, I'll go bunk out for a while or whatever, but nonetheless is the fee owner of the property. How do you deal with that little catch-all?
Representative Philston or testifier?
Okay. Well, we'll let Mr. Young address it first, and then if we have further questions, I'll follow up.
Mr. Young, would you address that question, please?
Yes, thank you. Well, I hope what would happen is the prosecutors, we all do, is we make decisions every single day about the facts of a case, and we don't make automatic application. We try to really figure out what's going on. In the example that you pose, a few things come to mind. If there has been an order for protection issued or a no-contact order by a court, we view that as sort of being the trump card to the situation that although the person might have a right to that property, for whatever those circumstances are, a court has ordered that person not to go there and not to be there. We have to consider that, whether the person was paying the rent, whether the person might be a married couple and is on the mortgage. It is a fact that we very much have to consider. Your example also questioned, what if the person wanted to just go back there and pick up a few personal items? That happens all the time. It's very common that a court will order defendants to have a police escort to go back there so they can accomplish that task. So for your concern, I think there already are a number of things in place that accommodate those things that happen in relationships all the time when they deteriorate to this level. But at the end of the day, we rely on our prosecutors to make judgment calls. And if there is some ambiguity, if there is some question about the right to access to that property, that would affect our ability to maybe prove up the burglary anyway, and we would have to consider whether we can go forward. So your scenario presents us with the types of things that we answer every single day.
Representative Herkos?
Thank you, and thanks for that explanation, and I would agree that that's probably a reasonable explanation. I just would hope that we don't have circumstances where an OFP is used to drive a fee owner out of their own home in favor of somebody, you know, living and having children out of wedlock or whatever the circumstance is, and then as a collateral consequence be charged with burglary for entering his own home.
All right, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. In my career in law enforcement, I've had a number of situations dealing with these issues where the respondent actually breaks into the home. They don't do it to go get property. They do it to terrorize. If you look at the domestic abuse statutes, and we've looked at it, and you look closely at it, this is putting fear in that in the petitioner's putting fear into the petitioner. That is domestic abuse by our statutes as well. So not only are they doing, as far as I'm concerned, they are committing a first degree burglary. They're also committing domestic assault by what our statutes read. And unless we get some stiff penalties for these people, it's going to continue. And we need to do what we can to protect these victims of domestic assault.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to any of the testifiers. I'm confused now. I'm totally supporting the bill and the concept. I just want to go back to enters a building. And then, so I was fine with the explanation until a building is a dwelling. So how does that count for the detached garage or the shed or something like that where someone could legitimately terrorize because I've been there kind of thing? I'm seeing a conflict, and maybe it's just in my own mind, but I'd appreciate it if you could clarify.
Well, first I'll explain, and then I'll let Mr. Young explain as well. But the third-degree burglary statute actually is the one that deals with the attached garage and the shed, not the first-degree burglary. So I misspoke when I described that. I didn't realize that it had that definition under the first-degree burglary statute. But Mr. Young, if he has anything else to clarify, that would be helpful.
Thank you. Representative Ward, these again become those fact-driven questions. Absolutely, it should be considered part of the abode and the dwelling if it's a shed or a detached garage, and those become those factual-driven parts of criminal law that are the most interesting is how do the facts of this case fit to the statute. That's why the definition of the building is a dwelling, we all probably have a vision of what a dwelling is, and we would agree on that, but what happens with some of these outbuildings or depending on, you know, your location, how do those work? But I can tell you I've had many cases where people live in what I would call a business, but because that's where they're living, that becomes the dwelling. So it's not just we can't just get stuck on the definitions. We really need to look at what the application of those definitions are. And if there were an attached garage and there was a forced entry and a person with an OFP against them was there or left a note that says something intimidating or anything at all when they weren't supposed to be there, this might not guarantee a better chance of prosecution, but it's another tool we can now use to help bring the most serious potential charges. So we look at sheds, at outbuildings, at anything that could be used that the victim might consider to be, this is my safe place, this is my home.
Representative Ward.
Just to follow up on clarification, so if someone goes in and destroys the garden, and so I mean we've talked about structures, mm-hmm. but I'm assuming that you're also talking about the yard, the gardens, the property, the land, could also be included in that?
Mr. Young.
That would be an application and definition that I don't think the courts have gone to yet. That might be for this body to consider whether they want that to be part of a dwelling. But at this point, the definitions of dwelling and structures and buildings really consider there must be some sort of structure. Going in the yard or the garden would not fit as currently drafted in these definitions. It could be something else. It could be harassment, stalking, going to the property. It could be a number of other potential crimes. It's not going to fit as a burglary because no structure was entered.
And members, just for clarification, this bill, unless I'm wrong, does not change the definitions that have been there for years. So whatever buildings, structures, granaries, barns, outhouses, outbuildings, stay the same in this bill. This isn't changing. And I don't think the author is probably too anxious to get into defining dwelling and curtilage and everything in this bill. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hellstrom. Just a quick question. So in essence, in passing this bill, what we now have is not really deterrent, because we all know that deterrents tend not to be the best things, but we have the opportunity to remove the perpetrator or the offender from, in essence, to protect the victim. We're able to take them and now prosecute them for a different crime and hopefully lock them up for a little while. And ultimately, what we're trying to do is we're not going to really protect the victim from that incident, because people, it doesn't matter if you change this law, people are still going to break in and do things. But ultimately, it creates the opportunity to actually have some recourse to further protect the victim after these events may happen.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think that people have already been prosecuting them this way. It's the case law that has made the confusion about whether or not it is or isn't. And so I just want to be clear in the statute, this is what we intend. And so hopefully people will realize by breaking into the home that, in fact, that is a more serious crime than me approaching you in public when there's a no-contact order. And currently, the way State v. Coven would be read, in many instances, it wouldn't be any different. And I would say when someone breaks into your home, when there's an order for protection, that's very, very different than someone coming up to you on the street in public.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So for me to be clear about this, then, in the circumstances in which you've illustrated, we're using the change in the law to increase the penalty from a misdemeanor for an order for protection to a felony offense in the circumstances you've outlined by entering a building, and particularly a felony offense for somebody entering property that they are the fee owner of.
Which one would you like to answer, or which one of you? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hertaus. I think part of the dynamic here, too, is we've looked at this, and we don't do prosecution. We're kind of on the civil side of things. Is that when you go from a misdemeanor to a felony, you're also really changing the process and the thought that goes into prosecuting these cases. You're now at a felony level. You're probably with a jury that you're going to have to convince of the elements of this case, as opposed to a misdemeanor level offense. So I think there's some pieces of that of the cases you're concerned about. I think as some of these cases gets considered, some of those facts all come together into play into a decision about which offense is the most appropriate and which one might be the best to secure conviction.
Mr. Chair.
Would it be fair to say that with this addition, the underlying words, that you're entering this violation into burglary of the first degree, which makes it a felony? So whether you call it enhancing the violation of an order for protection, it has to concern entering the building without consent. And
Mr. Chair,
Representative Hilston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want you all to know that you can get a felony violation for an order for protection now. You just have to have a certain number of priors in which you're doing. And so it isn't a new thing to have a felony violation of an order for protection. What we're saying is that they've already been prosecuted as a first-degree burglary in the past. This court case made it difficult to do that. But we are saying that, in fact, if you break into a residence or a home, the dwelling of a person, when there's a violation or when there's an order for protection, that it is a burglary, because that is how it was dealt with previously. So what I'm trying to do is put it back to where it was before the court said it wasn't there.
Okay, question. Representative Hurtaus.
Thank you. Okay, so somebody could violate an order for protection and terrorize someone outside of a residence, and it might be their first offense, and they're subject to a misdemeanor. But if they do it by entering potentially what could be deemed their own home as far as a fee owner, if that would be the circumstance, then they could be subjected to a different penalty and be charged with a felony for a first violation. Is that correct?
Mr. Young.
Thank you. I think that's a potential. But it's not done lightly, because before you get to the point where the person enters at home without permission, there's already been a finding. A court has either issued a no-contact order, an order for protection, perhaps they're on probation for an underlying domestic incident. So it's not as if there hasn't already been some hearing as to whether that person, albeit a fee owner, shouldn't be there. There's already been a finding made that the victim is just as entitled to be at that place, maybe raising the family, doing whatever it is that person needs to do. And the court has said to a suspect, based on this order, you can't go there. And if you go there, that's without consent. And just as the example we're using, we're saying if you go to that one place where that victim hopes to have the most privacy, the most safety, and you go there against that court order, that now ratchets up what might otherwise be a misdemeanor if you text them or email them. We're saying if you do that now, where that person is supposed to have the most sanctity and safety, that can be this potential felony.
Representative Hurtaus.
And I guess I understand that, and I, in general practice, support what you're trying to do. I'm just looking at the application of the penalty doesn't seem to be necessarily uniform based on where that violation of the OFP occurs. And I understand the argument about the safety of your own home and whatnot, but I just would be concerned for that rare circumstance that somebody may be misinformed in terms of what their rights are as being a property owner and make that entry. Thank you.
And again, I go back. If that
Ms.
was...
Young. Go ahead.
Thank you. I apologize.
No problem.
Mr. Chair. That's what we do every single day. Is it's our responsibility to look at the facts and circumstances of every single case before we make the charge. If there was a legitimate argument or a confusion, what we see sometimes is paperwork is not accurate or filled out, we have every responsibility to make sure that what we're doing is the right thing to do based on the facts and circumstances.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hurtaug, I worked in a jail for 21 years as a counselor with the offenders. I think you hit a nerve on the fact that oftentimes some of my clients weren't the brightest people in the world, and they didn't understand things. And I did see some abuses of orders for protection. But I think it's more of an educational thing. Yeah, you can't go. That's all there is to it. And if there's still the order of protection, you need to deal with that before you deal with anything else. Afterwards, I'll tell you about some of the stories that I had, but they were amazing sometimes that guys would come bouncing back into jail, and you'd look at them and go, well, you know, there was an order for protection. Oh, I forgot. Yeah, it's education and having it explained to the offenders sometimes needs to be a better job needs to be done.
Okay. Moral of the story is don't go into a home without consent and violation of order of protection. It's kind of on the basis of the castle doctrine. That's why we figure that's so important. The home is your castle. It shouldn't be violated. We'll talk about that in another bill.
All right.
So anyway, any more questions? You got anybody in the list?
What's that?
Representative Hillsman, unless you got something more, I'll ask if there's anybody in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill. Yes, sir. Have a seat. Give your name and who you represent, or if you're just citizenry, and go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Rick Keller, unofficially representing the Twice Exceptional and Quick Disabled. About this bill, I always look at words I recognize, electronic. It's important that it's just a technology regarding these type of documents when they're provided are fully accessible according to Statute 16E. State agencies are required to follow that. However, the legislature...
Sir, I think you're talking about the wrong bill. I think you're on the next one.
Is that the 241 bill?
We're on 199.
We're on 199.
We're on 199 right now, but you're welcome to come back if you'd like to wait till the next one.
Yeah, I think I shall.
All right, no problem. Thank you, sir. Representative Hillstrom, it doesn't look like there's anybody else ready. Do you have any closing comments?
Members, I hope that we'll be able to work out the fiscal note, and I hope we'll be able to pass this bill into law. Thank you,
Representative Hillstrom. And House File 199 will be held over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Would you like to approach House File 241?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 241 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Members, this is a bill that really gets to the crux of technology getting ahead of the law. And we've seen that, you know, there's widespread use of social media now, and so that's a new form of interaction, a new form of harassment, and it allows all sorts of trouble to be caused. This bill really deals with the issue of when someone impersonates someone else for the purpose of harassing them or causing them harm. So we've had a few examples, and I have Isani County with me that are going to talk about the case that they had in 2013. So I'm going to quickly talk about two other cases that are kind of out there. In 2013 in Maryland, that wasn't here, a victim's ex-boyfriend impersonated her, posted advertisement on multiple websites such as rapemeandmydaughters.com, and they included advertisements which included the victim's photograph and home address, and then numerous men showed up at the residence wanting to have sex with, expecting to have sex with the victim. So someone else pretended to be the victim looking to cause harm. Our law in Minnesota is not clear, and I think you'll see that we need to clean that up. Early in 2014, there was a case where someone posted on the internet an advertisement in which they impersonated his ex-girlfriend and solicited sex from random men. The victim learned of the posting after the men started calling her and asking her for sex. The posting included a photograph of the victim in which the perpetrator obtained from the victim's Facebook page. So, Your Honor, I apologize, Mr. Chair.
I always wonder where were on them robes.
So
in August of 2013, Isani County had a case, and I'd really like them to talk about the case that they have, because I think it speaks volumes about why I'm here asking you to amend the bill, the law.
Okay, sir, would you give us your name and title and proceed?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Edblatt. I am the Isani County Attorney, and I have served in that capacity since January of 1995, and I want to thank Representative Hillstrom for her work on House File 241 and encourage that that be adopted by this committee. As this committee is aware, with the proliferation of electronic devices and the proliferation of social media, there has been a whole nother avenue opened up for individuals to victimize others. And a great deal of time, attention, and energy has been spent on the use of electronic devices, social media, in the area of identity theft as it relates to property crimes and financial crimes. But there is also a side to the misuse of electronic devices that lead to harm to reputation and harm to individuals personally. And we're here to speak to that this morning, and I would defer my time at this point, Mr. Chair, with the Chair's permission to Assistant County Attorney Deanna Natoli, who is the prosecutor on the case in question.
Okay, ma'am, could you state your name and title over again and proceed? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Deanna Natoli. I'm going to scoot a little closer. And I'm an Assistant County, Isani County Attorney. The case that I am speaking of was prosecuted by myself and actually is pending in the Court of Appeals with an oral argument date next month. But factually, the case involved a man who was dating a woman. She was examining herself and discovered what she thought could be a sexually transmitted infection, spoke to him about that, and he got very upset and accused her of cheating. His response then was to go onto Craigslist, which is a form of social media, and he posted two different ads at 4:30 in the morning, I believe on August 30th of 2013. One of them, there's a lot of vulgar language, so I'm not going to quote it unless specifically asked, but one of them was impersonating the adult ex-girlfriend, referring to her as a cheater and that she would be willing to have sex with anybody that contacted her. It listed her first name and it listed her phone number. Then a posting within a few minutes after that indicated again that it was a female, this time a 17-year-old female who would have been the daughter of the adult ex-girlfriend, offering to have sex with individuals, whoever contacted her. Again, a lot of vulgarity that I'm trying to politely put, although it's hard for me to do. The response was that there were men who contacted both of these females. First, the daughter, the 17-year-old, received photos of erect penises. She received videos of males masturbating, and she received numerous text messages asking where they could meet up and that somebody was only 20 minutes away from Isani because it did advertise a location. The mom, or the ex-girlfriend, also received messages offering to meet up, and then at that point she contacted law enforcement, and they began their investigation. Ultimately, this defendant admitted that he did do the postings, and he was charged with criminal defamation. Excuse me, two counts, one for each victim. And as I indicated, that is pending in the Court of Appeals due to some issues with the defamation statute. But ultimately, the facts of that case, as I've outlined, meet that statute subject to the Court of Appeals interpretation, but it also would meet this electronic impersonation as outlined by Representative Hillstrom. And if I have, I can answer any questions that the body may have.
The first question I would have is I don't see a real problem with it when you describe the events, the heinous things that were said. But what about my problem naturally runs with harassment is described as repeated incidents of intrusive or unwanted acts, words, or gestures. What about somebody impersonates another and puts a bottle of booze by the picture and said, I'm an alcoholic, or if somebody puts a picture of you blown up in a heavier condition and say, I've got a weight problem, or some that type of harassment that's annoying, but not nearly as threatening as what you did here, and then charging them with a felony. So if you could elaborate on that, how are you going to separate the definition of what harassment is or isn't by the way it's defined in 609 748 sub 1 paragraph 8 clause 1?
Mr. Chair, if I may, as Assistant County Attorney for Anoka County, Paul Young spoke about with regard to the last bill, there is a great deal of discretion with regard to reviewing these cases. And I believe Representative Hillstrom also used the statement, it depends. And it can be kind of a frustrating statement, but it's a situation that, depending on the facts of the case, depending on what happens, depending on the definitions, is something that I would anticipate prosecutorial discretion to come into. It's a situation where the conduct could run the gamut of any kind of harassment. It could be the harassment as we have presented in the case. It could be harassment such as the chair has talked about, or it could be the harassment of purporting to be any member of us in the room, ascribing to us views that are not consistent with our personal views, statements that we would not make that would be offensive or harmful to others. So it is something that would have to be cognizant from a prosecutorial discretion and looking at the conduct and determining what would be the appropriate course of action. But this bill does give a mechanism for the prosecution of cases such as Ms. Natoli has testified to that have become problematic with the potential constitutionality issue of the criminal defamation bill.
Representative Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when we took the tour of the BCA, I also learned about instances where people are taking over minors' Facebook pages and then posting pornographic videos and pornographic information, so that that information then goes out to the friends of the children whose Facebook pages they have taken over. At this point, that would be it's a challenge. But so there's discussion about whether or not there needed to be a criminal defamation statute or criminal impersonation statute in that context as well. So, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to continue to work with the committee to make sure we're going to get a fiscal note on whether or not this costs any money. I'm happy to see if we can't, you know, split hairs and deal with those issues. But the real issue we're getting at here is when you're really attempting to cause harm. You're attempting to cause harm by someone either viewing those pornographic images that are children. You're attempting to cause harm to the person by having people show up. That's what I think, and I think the statute needs to be fixed.
We've got several questions here. Representative Lucero, Quam, and Howe. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have is, if this same behavior by the perpetrator, which was the mechanism used was the digital realm, if the same behavior was used via mechanisms in the physical realm, whether it be ads in the newspaper with, you know, or maybe writings on bathroom stalls, right? There's multiple different mechanisms that could be used in the physical realm. What would this same behavior be charged with statutorily or criminally? And then what would the penalty be?
To just succinctly, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Thank you, and Representative, to succinctly answer your question, I don't think that there is an equivalent, but fact-wise, as Mr. Young, who testified before, indicated, there may be other charges. Specifically, if it's a repeated thing, you could look at a stalking offense based on continued behavior. It could be, I don't want to speculate too much, but it just kind of depends on what it is. If you use a newspaper, but you essentially submitted that online, that this could fall into that because there is some electronic component through online newspapers and things of that. But it would just depend. I hate answering it that way, but that is true.
Representative Lucero, follow up.
I was thinking about that, but thank you, Mr. Chair, about a follow up. But I'm trying to put into words here. So prior to the internet, if I wanted to cause. If I wanted to incite others to harass an individual, right, there would be other mechanisms. So if I heard you correctly, you're having difficulty coming up with what somebody would be charged with, but there must be something where if I engage in behavior to advertise right, to falsely impersonate somebody, to incite people to harass an individual, they must be able to be charged with something. So I'm just seeking if maybe there isn't a clear answer for that, but if there is, it's what I'm looking for.
Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, may I respond?
Oh, yes, ma'am, go ahead.
Thank you. Representative, I think the current mechanism would be to pursue the criminal defamation statute. I'm just hesitant to advise you with that because of the issues that may result from this case in the Court of Appeals. So there's some work that would have to be done on that statute. That's what I believe.
Okay, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in reference to just previous discussion, some mail fraud convictions have happened with what's been hinted at here in the real world. I don't have a problem with making a felony for the very egregious things. And I think what some of the questions and hints are is refining the definition so that we go from, you know, a felony for egregious things, yes. I don't want to trust prosecutorial discretion for boorish behavior that now translates into a felony dependent on who the prosecutor, you know, the county attorney is, and dependent maybe on who your family and your background and wealth and capability are, because the law should be independent of influences and not discriminate against those that don't have those things. And so when we're discussing, don't let anyone think that we're trying to excuse abhorrent behavior. But what we're trying to do is make sure that we don't have the unintended consequence of ruining a person's life with a felony conviction for what would, I think most of us would consider, boorish behavior. And so I would hope the author and those involved during this process could refine it down so that there wouldn't be unintended consequences or another visit back because a judge made a determination. Thank you.
Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will go down that same line. If we had this, that it was sexual in nature, or there was something in there about the that type of behavior, I would tend to be supportive. But as I read this, there would be nothing. I would say that the actors and the folks on Saturday Night Live would all be guilty of a felony as I read this, because I think TV now is electronic media. You could put it on YouTube. You can do whatever. I'd be as widely and as broadly as this could be interpreted, I would say they all ought to get representation, because I would believe that you could get someone could, because if it's just because they say something that they wouldn't normally say, I could think of numerous Saturday Night Live skits that they have people up there saying things that those folks would not normally say and be attributed to them. So I agree with Representative Quam that it needs to be more narrowly scoped here, because I think it's, as I broadly read this and apply it, I think I'd be worried about its application.
Thank you. Representative Neuberger. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we want to address two things. So one, we just took the definition of harassment out of the statute. I didn't want to rewrite the harassment statute in terms of the action. So that's what we included here. But it isn't always sexual in nature. Sometimes it's racial in nature as well. And so I'd actually like the assistant county attorney here to actually talk about, because this case did involve some racial issues as well.
I think what they're getting at here is we didn't have a problem with somebody running through the front door violating the order for protection. So much is the open end here. And the word harassment is probably what's clouding the issue and what that could be defined as in the wide scope, rather than running through a door on in a private home, and so that's what we're struggling with, is the scope of it and the range of the prosecutorial discretion. If you could address that, go ahead, sir. Or ma'am, whichever one you want.
Well, I'll first defer to Mr. Ed Black, but then, okay. I would understand that it's hard to trust that all the prosecutors out there would have the sense of discretion that you all would expect. I think that the definition of harassment, as it's used in other statutes, holds prosecutors to that same standard. It's not giving us more than prosecutors would already have. Mr. Chair, with respect to your question, there is some leeway, but the definition itself, as defined in 609.748, there are certain requirements that I have to be able to meet, or any prosecutor has to be able to meet, to first define harassment before I even get to the rest of this bill, or rest of the offense. And as Representative Hillstrom indicated, it's not only sexual in nature, which was brought up by the body, but there's also some racial issues that would have to somehow be tailored, again, into this definition of harassment. But that happened in this case. Like I said, I wasn't going to quote his language, but it was very inappropriate.
Mr. Chair, and at times very racially charged.
Okay. Did you want to cover anything, or did Representative Neuberger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted a clarification. I had a comment and then a question as well. I'll start with my question. How would you, the world that we live in, excuse me, there are maniacal people and there are also vindictive people as well. Now, the intent of what you're trying to do here, God bless you. I have three daughters and I like what you're trying to do here. With that said, though, given the world that we live in, how do you prove that the accuracy of a case like this, and are the resources there to do that? The example I'll give you is, let's say you have one individual who is upset with another individual, so they go ahead and they generate one of these. They understand how this law works. They go ahead and generate a false website or a false Facebook posting or a false, web posting, with the intent to entrap someone else. And it's really easy. It takes 5 minutes to sit down on your computer and fire up some kind of a electronic ad. You have one individual who fires up a false ad, goes to the police and says, "Look what my ex-boyfriend just did to me," and now this person, or this my ex-girlfriend did to me. And now this person is facing a potential felony charge. So my question is how would you go about proving the validity of these posts?
I can address how that happened in this specific case.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Mr. Chair.
No problem.
In this specific case, it was once the listings were posted and the victims were aware of them, law enforcement was contacted. Law enforcement reviewed the ads and preserved them by printing them off, made contact with Craigslist to get the information of not only the IP address, the service provider, any information that could show what account this came from. From that information, all tied to the individual, Mr. Turner, and then he was subsequently interviewed and upon confronting with all that information did admit to doing it. So that helped my case, but even without his admission, the other information up to that point was sufficient to tie him to this.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the clarification on that, and I think that was an important point that I needed to clear up in my mind. I do have one comment about this, though. I wonder how far, believe it or not, people have opinions about me, and how will this apply to political speech? You go on Google, and you go. There's all kinds of political satire websites where all kinds of things that are intended to be humorous, harassing, or anywhere in between are posted, and we also have the First Amendment protections there. However, are we starting to step into an area where we might be crossing that line, where as much as the humor I do see in some of the things written about me, some of this could be, or you, or well, wouldn't be against Representative Winkler, but if we have anything like that, how do we know? I mean, are we going to be slowly creeping into our First Amendment speech with political satire, political blogs, and as we all know, political speech can get pretty cutting.
Why don't you go ahead and answer that, and then if we that ends the questions, I think, if we could. And remember, this is going to be held over for a possible conclusion, and I think the author has gotten a signal from us that we would like to see it narrowed, and we'll work on it before the next appearance. But go ahead and answer the question anybody would like.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd just start with, there's a difference between something that someone is saying about you and when someone pretends to be you and says something about you. So even imagine as a politician, someone creating a Facebook account, a Twitter account, pretending to be you, and there is no indication. You know, it doesn't say fake Deborah Hillstrom. It doesn't indicate in any way. And they purport, in an attempt to harass you, based on the statute, that everything they say are things that you actually said, or things that you actually wanted, or things that you were actually doing. That's a problem. And right now, I am not sure that our statute is clear. That again, it's the difference when you are criminally taking on the identity of the person you're trying to harass. And that's really what this is about. Attempt to harass them as them by putting out information. Yes. We also have someone, right, she can actually answer the
two more questions, and the man that wants to testify and sentencing guidelines. So, Representative Neuberger?
I'll be brief. Mr. Chair, thank you. And Representative Hellstrom, I get what you're saying, but the flag that comes up for me is when we go into the realm of political satire. And I think that, that's an area right here that's relatively blurred. I absolutely support what you're doing here, but this is, there's always a million rabbit trails, and this is one that kind of springs up a flag for me.
So.
Go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The First Amendment issue is one that I plan to argue before the Court of Appeals, but political speech, as you're indicating, would be something protected by the First Amendment, and that's not the type of conduct that we're talking here. There are very different levels when we're talking First Amendment based on who the person is and what the content is. A public figure being talked about satirically on a public issue is not what would be prosecuted under this bill. As Representative Hillstrom indicated, we're talking about pretending to be someone so that that person suffers a harm, and that's different from what the First Amendment would protect on political speech or other protected issues. This type of conduct would not be protected.
Okay, Representative, which one? Who had a question? Anybody? Her thoughts. Go ahead.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, in the last election cycle, there were some constitutional office candidates in Minnesota that had fake Twitter accounts established that were not them. And so what you're describing in this bill is an impersonation of somebody else, and if that person could be found to establish that account, is guilty under this scenario. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, she just said no.
Okay. And then previous to some of the other questions, I heard you state this morning in testimony that this doesn't give us anything more than we already have. If that is the case, then why do we need this law?
Ma'am, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, what I indicated was the definition of harassment, as it's indicated in this bill, is the same as the definition that I'm held to on other statutes, like stalking and in the OFP statute, things like that. So that definition doesn't change here. This would give a new law, so I don't want to be unclear on that. It does give me something new, but it's the definition is the same as what I'm already held to.
Thank you.
Okay. Members, we'll have, sir, you still want to testify? Come on down. give us your thoughts, and then if nobody else follows you, then we'll hold it over for possible inclusion. Go ahead, sir. Is your name, and if you give us your name again.
Yeah, my name is Rick Heller. Thank you for this opportunity to speak. I officially represent the Twice Exceptional. I'm currently speaking on this House File 241. Based on my oral understanding today, one might consider this kind of goes into special education in a way, I think, because they had a bill some time ago about bullying and had to do with the internet. And not every special ed student, in fact, every is a catchword, understand the complications of content. And since we're opening it up more, not just for special ed, with the use of assistive technology based on universal design principles. But from my understanding, when you try to track somebody that uses the internet, you may have there some important information. However, with the internet and what's out there, people can learn how to bounce off other people's URLs. And I don't know how proficient the justice system is as far as identifying specifically that that was that person. So it's something you might want to consider for those individuals as well. I agree, anybody that's an adult, not necessarily 18, because many kids continue to have a print disability past age 18, or they're blind. They don't quite get it. Probably they're late bloomers, or take them 8 years to find out even what type of work they want to do. And in the meantime, they might get a little bored in the process and do some things that they don't even understand. And can't stress it enough, they don't have appropriate access understandings that you're going to be a felon and that you're going to be part of the school-to-prison pipeline, because Minnesota's goal is to turn it into a talented pipeline. I appreciate this time to speak.
Thank you, sir. And with that, unless you have any comments, we'll hold that bill over, House File 241, for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, member.
Now we'll move right into the Sentencing Guidelines Commission budget. Nathaniel Wright, the executive director. Welcome, sir. If you say your name and title and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Nate Reitz. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. We did have a chance to talk a couple of weeks ago about the overview, so I'm just going to be discussing the budget, and I'll attempt to be brief. Thank you for this opportunity to return. This is the governor's request for the upcoming FY16-17 biennium for the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. It's a request of approximately $1.2 million over the biennium. 86% of this request is for agency personnel costs, as you can see in this chart. And I'll discuss how this is a change from the previous biennium in a moment, but before we get to that, I'd like to show you again this slide that shows the personnel makeup of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines. We have 6 full-time personnel.
Members, excuse me, sir. If you'd like to follow along, there's a tab in your budget book there, Sentencing Guidelines, towards the back. Sorry, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The commission employs 6 full-time staff, including myself, who are responsible for the work of the commission. We did prepare preliminary fiscal notes on the last 2 bills, for example, and review all sentencing worksheets in the state of Minnesota, provide assistance to probation officers throughout the state who are looking for guidance on how to implement the sentencing guidelines and so forth. This chart shows the past 10 years of, including the next biennium, of the agency budget. The FY16-17 budget request, which is the chart on the right, does show an increase of about 2% biennium to biennium in the agency's operating budget over FY14-15, the current biennium. I understand that this increase reflects anticipated rising costs of employee compensation. Now you'll see there's a bump on the FY14-15 budget request. That's a $300,000 special appropriation. That is not included in the 2% increase that I'm talking about. If that were included, it would be a decrease. The special appropriation was for the new electronic worksheet project. I'll be talking about that in just a moment. We called around to some other states with similar sentencing guidelines to the state of Minnesota just for comparison on a per capita basis. Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission cost the taxpayers 11 cents per capita. I should say that the residents of Minnesota 11 cents per capita, which compares favorably to some of these other states. You'll see Oregon's a little higher. They have a broader mission than our mission. They also do work on overseeing the drug court program throughout the state of Oregon. As I said, I would like to talk a little bit about the 2013 special appropriation that the legislature gave us, $300,000 to support the new electronic worksheet system. Probation officers prepare sentencing worksheets as part of each felony pre-sentence investigation. The worksheets reflect the guidelines presumptive sentence for a particular felony conviction. Judges and attorneys rely on these important documents to make accurate sentencing decisions. In 2013, the legislature, with the backing of the state's criminal justice community, made a special appropriation to fund the modernization of the worksheet process. With the support of Minute and the Department of Corrections, the project was launched statewide, and the project was closed in 2014, I'm pleased to say. The project has succeeded in its goals of increasing efficiency and improving the reliability of the worksheet and reducing errors. It reduces errors by integrating with the court information system, which is called MNSIS. It automatically takes the MNSIS data and populates the worksheet data with the MNSIS data, which was an important thing. It reduces transcription errors. So, again, we're going for accuracy in these sentencing worksheets, and this improves that. Although it can be overridden manually, it is an accurate starting point. It also promotes efficiency, where you have these probation officers spend quite a bit of time making each one of these worksheets. If you have a repeat offender, he or she has a prior worksheet or multiple prior worksheets in the system, that data can now be copied automatically to populate the new worksheet, which is a great starting point. And finally, it improves reliability. There's now an automatic sentence calculator that calculates all the different modifiers, exceptions, and offenses that can apply in a particular case, and gives a more accurate calculation for the worksheet that the judge can then use in fashioning an appropriate sentence. Subject to your questions, Mr. Chair, that concludes the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission budget presentation.
Thank you, sir. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it goes off of MNSIS. What do you do when there's out-of-state convictions?
Those would have to be entered manually. And even if there's anything, can be overridden manually. But yes, we have to calculate out-of-state convictions manually. And that's that. We get a lot of calls on those because that does involve some judgment in terms of it has to be equated to a Minnesota offense to give it a score.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then do you have to manually calculate the box then as well, or does it take into account the whatever value you give it from the out-of-state conviction?
Mr. Wright.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I believe it does automatically calculate it based on the entry of the points that were put in.
Okay. Any questions in from any more members? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is kind of brief. So is this actually going to then save a little bit of time and resources for the staff in sentencing guidelines? Because now a lot of the stuff is automated that probably used to be done by an individual. So I'm curious, as I think about your budget, the appropriation that allowed this to get put in place, are there some efficiencies that have come with that?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, thank you. I would say the most of the efficiencies that come out through the new EWS process are at the probation officer level, where they're able to prepare the worksheets and hopefully spend more time actually supervising offenders rather than preparing sentencing worksheets for us. we still review every worksheet to make sure it's accurate. We still have to review 100%, which is actually a larger number than it used to be with the increase in felony sentencing. So, but what we're finding is that there are fewer errors of these, you know, calculation type of errors. Those errors are being reduced. We used to find a significant number of errors, and there's some risk there that we're just going to miss some mistakes, and they're going to slip through to the sentencing process, and that's what we want to avoid at all costs.
Okay. Members, if you're satisfied with your questions, that's all I have. Thank you, Director, for being here and presenting, and we'll adjourn until tomorrow.